Welcome. We are set today on case number 84444, State of Nevada versus John Mark Fenton. As you can see, one of our panel members, Justice Pickering, is appearing from the Las Vegas courtroom today, and Justice Bell and I are here. We are set today for a 30-minute argument, which of course means 15 minutes each, and probably you know this, but sometimes people seem to be confused, so let me ask first, counsel, are you going to want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
And how much time? So you'll just stop when you're ready to. Okay. Okay. So for you, it'll stop when you choose, but the yellow light will come on when each of you has 5 minutes left and you'll hear a tone, and then it'll go to red when you've used up your time. So if your whole 15 minutes clock will be running, so if you want to reserve time, you'll need to stop, because if it gets to zero, you're out of time. Okay? All right, with that, counsel, you ready?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's start. Go ahead.
Thank you. So as I noted in my brief, that this court in Clark said that
Sorry, counsel. Can you pronounce your name for me?
Barankum.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
So in Clark v. State, this court held that not every, or that we need to look at the facts of each case when we're talking about actual conflicts of interest. And in this specific case, the question before the court is, does a violation of the rules of professional conduct result in a per se finding of ineffective assistance of counsel for the purposes of Collier v. Sullivan, puts the courts in situations where prejudice is presumed when we're talking about the Sixth Amendment. And the question specifically about this case is specific to Nevada Rule of Professional Conduct 1.8J, which just defines saying that the lawyer shall not engage in a sexual relationship with their client after the commencement of the representation. This court has the opportunity to be one of the first, if not the first, court to opine on this issue. And obviously it's the position of the state that we need to look at this in a case-by-case basis, and that the facts of this case do not dictate that a per se finding happen, that you're still weighing the prongs of Strickland against the facts of this case. And my argument is kind of boiled down into...
Do you have a question about that, though? Is it
yes.
Really the Strickland standard where we're looking at prejudice in, you know, that there would have been a different outcome, or is it Kyler where we're looking at adverse impact on counsel's performance?
In my opinion, it's the first, because you can have a situation where, say, you have two different cases, similar facts or however, the attorneys make the same mistake. There's deficient performance on both cases, just that one of the cases happens to have the sexual relationship. Take that out of that. Are you still going to be weighing that with the prejudice prong of Strickland?
How would that be any different than if we're looking at the traditional Kyler conflicted counsel, like representing two people? How would that be any different?
Because in that case, that was a dual representation case where the attorney in that case was forced to make a decision between somebody else's interests or his client's. And with a relationship, and especially this relationship, the interests of the attorney align with the clients, align with the defendants, if that makes sense.
Well, but doesn't having this relationship put the counsel in sort of dual roles of romantic partner and counsel, and isn't there a kind of a conflict in the way you deal with people in those different roles?
Correct. There is. And that's one of the highlights of that case out of Utah, the Utah Court of Appeals case, State v. Cheek, which is it's when the attorney's own interests fall out of line with their clients. So in this case, you could say, and by the way, the state at the lower court conceded that there was this relationship. Ms. Kilpatrick admitted to it. The state does not condone what happened.
Sure.
And she should certainly be subject to discipline. But how does that affect the case? And so in that State v. Cheek case, it was, to kind of quickly quote it, to establish an actual conflict, the defendants must demonstrate as a threshold matter that the defense attorney was required to make a choice advancing, in this case, her own interests to the detriment of her client's interests. And so what is detrimental to the attorney advancing those interests of the relationship? Because if she, and in this case, the relationship enhanced her representation as she testified to. Judge Maddox made a comment that she did a good job. And so there was no detriment to Mr. Fenton because of this relationship. If that occurred before trial, the testimony was that it came after trial by Ms. Kilpatrick. But it's where those
what's the difference between looking for that detriment and the prejudice standard in Strickland, then? Like, what is the difference then between applying the Kiewer standard and the Strickland standard?
Because the difference would be, we're just going to presume prejudice. We're going to find that if you were to apply Kiewer to all of this blanket rule, and this is also kind of my policy argument that I was going to raise later. But you're going to see a situation where you're going to get a lot of claims that I was in a relationship with my attorney. And you're going to be flooded with these claims once they hear that all I have to do is allege this this relationship and I get a new trial, irrespective of how much evidence was against me.
Well, but that isn't really the Kiewer test, right? There's two parts. There has to be the conflict, and then there also has to be an adverse effect on counsel's performance.
Correct. And that was brought up in Kiewer. And so it must have adversely affected his lawyer's performance, is what the quote in Kiewer is. And so that's where you have to look and see if the relationship adversely affected the representation. And there was nothing brought up at the lower court to say that the relationship caused any deficient performance or caused any effect. In fact, all of the alleged grounds, the remaining 2, 4, 6, and 8, I believe, were withdrawn and abandoned at the hearing. So what we're left with is, first of all, it didn't even get to get that. We don't know. We just know that there was a relationship. And so relationship, but then all the evidence points to the fact that Ms. Kilpatrick fought harder for Mr. Fenton, as opposed to something being blinding her and she fell.
So what about Judge Maddox's findings? Apparently he found credible Mr. Fenton's testimony about him feeling like he couldn't address issues with his counsel, couldn't talk to her, couldn't challenge her, that he was kind of stuck in this circumstance, and that appeared to cause some real concern for Judge Maddox. How would you address that?
It was belied by the record.
How so?
So you have the transcript of the prison calls by Mr. Fenton to Ms. Kilpatrick in the appendix 430, pages 434 through 647. Additionally, I can't find the number off the top of my head. Actually, I can. It's in the state's original opposition to the petition. There was that one ground that talked about not putting on certain testimony, Dr. Richteroff is who it was. And Ms. Kilpatrick cited to, she said they were trying to figure out if they were going to stick with one defense versus go another, make a strategy call, which would have totally been her call anyway.
Right.
One of the things she noted in there is that she, and was brought up by the state, is that she discussed this with Mr. Fenton, and there didn't appear to be issues there. And then specifically when we looked at...
But what if he, I don't know, I mean, I'm just, based on the record, what if he thought that he couldn't raise his disagreement because of the other nature of their relationship?
But did it really adversely affect her representation? Did she do a bad job as a result? And also, and to further my point about it, about being belied by the record, when you look at pages 461 and 462 of the appellant's appendix, Mr. Fenton began the call saying, at the end of the last phone call, I started to hear, and I love you. And he responded, he goes, I wanted to tell you that I love you back. So that's where it doesn't appear, based on the rest of the record and based on those exhibits that were admitted at the evidentiary hearing, that he was really in that position. And Judge Maddox, I don't have the page off the top of my head, but Judge Maddox made a comment later on, is that he may be not telling the truth about that. But that was the comments there.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. This is Justice Pickering from Las Vegas.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you make anything of the fact that the ethics rule, and I get that the ethics rules don't necessarily dictate criminal procedure, but the rule says a lawyer shall not have sexual relations with a client. And the Utah case you rely on, State versus Cheek, the Utah drafters add a definition of sexual relations to mean sexual intercourse. To be direct here, there was no sexual intercourse in this case, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, but based on some of the content.
Do you make anything of that distinction here in terms of the rule, or do you concede that whatever was going on between them, it violated Rule 1.8J?
And you're right. Do I concede that? I guess I can. Because when you look at some of the calls, there were talks about some sexual nature. Like specifically on 463, there was page 463, there was a conversation where Mr. Fenton asked Ms. Kilpatrick, are you home? She said, yes. And he said, oh, I have you all to myself. And there was a sexual...
innuendo.
Yes. Yeah. Sexual conversation that took place from there. But even if we wanted it to go just romantic relationship, I guess you could argue that that does create an issue. But the one question that I do have before I reserve the rest of my time is, what's the difference between this, if we were going to say that the relationship commenced before the representation, we'd still be looking at the Strickland standard and we wouldn't be applying Kyler. And with that, I want to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you.
I have one follow-up question before you sit down, and it was what put me in mind of the wording of the rule. It strikes me that there are lawyer-client relationships where the lawyer is very domineering and the client feels intimidated by the lawyer. And I'd like your thoughts on what it is we're evaluating in this conflict for purposes of the Quiller case, or Kyler, I'm not sure how to say the name. But isn't it more like a actual shading of by the lawyer of the client's interest in the representation more than something intimidating or awkward between the lawyer and the client?
Well, you also have to look at what are the client's choices in the matter, whether or not they had the option to testify or to plead. And then when you kind of have the domineering sense in trial, that's purely within the attorney's realm. They get to make all the strategy calls. So... that's kind of, I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's the kind of the way I look at it. And there was, and later on in the, in page 591, Ms. Kilpatrick made, during one of these calls, made a recommendations, specific recommendations to Mr. Fenton on other attorneys and said, what you do is ultimately your decision. So the inference raised there is that he also had the decisions in the trial. And if I can still reserve time, thank you.
Sure. All right, counsel.
Good May it please the court. Christopher Day on behalf of respondent John Fenton. The facts in this case are, and Ms. Kilpatrick's behavior was extraordinary and egregious and resulted in Mr. Fenton having a total deprivation of a true and meaningful attorney-client relationship. Judge Maddox took the, and you can see from his findings on, and this is in appendix page 843, took the, this was only the second time in his career that he granted a habeas petition, and really finding that truly the facts in this case were, again, egregious and extraordinary. There are really two distinct, the way I see it, conflicts of interest that are present in this case and that were focused on by Judge Maddox. The first, which has been discussed at length already, was the, of course, initiation of a sexual relationship that violates 1.8J. But additionally, and what really was the focus of Judge Maddox's order was Ms. Kilpatrick's breach of the duty of loyalty to Mr. Fenton, and that would be encompassed in Rule 1.7A and 1.8B. Specifically, early on in the case, in her representation of Mr. Fenton, she turned him in to law enforcement. She admitted to that in the habeas hearing. Now, she had reasons. She felt she had a moral reason to turn him in. He was on pretrial release pending trial. She was appointed to represent him through the public defender's office. She believed he was had relapsed and was using drugs around his children. And she called law enforcement to check up on him, which led to his arrest. And Judge Maddox found specifically that, and this is again in the appendix around page 800, he makes a specific finding that that was a breach of the duty of loyalties. And I would say that's separate and distinct from the initiation of a sexual relationship. And I would go further to say that either of those breaches, either independently or most especially in combination, create the prejudice that's presumed that we talked about in the Kyler case.
What's the adverse effect on representation?
And I think that's the difficult question for this court in crafting the opinion is what was the actual effect? I think what stands out to me is the unanswered, well, first, there's the obvious disadvantage that he was placed back into custody. And that's something your attorney's not supposed to have you placed back into custody.
Well, there's a specific exception to that rule that allows it if there's a risk of substantial bodily harm to somebody, and arguably that applies here.
Certainly, and Judge Maddox did find that. And he says in his finding that did she have a moral duty or arguably an exception? Sure, but at that point she should have withdrawn. And there were other potential conflicts in this case that were fleshed out on the record, and waivers were discussed on the record, prior representation in the public defender's office of an alternate suspect. Some of those conflicts were discussed. It was not discussed ever, Ms. Kilpatrick's continuing representation of Mr. Fenton after breaching her duty of loyalty.
So with her having chosen to continue representation in that circumstance, what was the adverse effect on that representation?
And Mr. Fenton testified, and Judge Maddox found it credible, that at that point, from that point on, early on in this case, he no longer could trust Ms. Kilpatrick. He felt trapped. He didn't feel he could be open and candid with his counsel. And that affected, and it's hard to actually probably put into words or actual tangible effects what that led to. I mean, in preparing for any criminal trial like this, there's innumerable choices that some of them are strategic, some of them are choices of the client. But at that point, he didn't feel he could have an open and candid discussion with her. Something as notable in this case, he did not elect to testify. That discussion is a very difficult discussion to have with a client, and ultimately it's their decision, but you have to have a open, trusting, candid relationship. And he testified months prior, pending trial, he did not have that. So that's a big choice in this case. His defense was that it wasn't him. It's a big decision if your defense is you have the wrong person to not testify. I mean, I think there's reasonable people could disagree, but he couldn't form a reasonable decision because he didn't have counsel he could rely on.
But has he argued that he would have made a different decision or something would have been better if that happened? Because I mean, I understand what you're saying, I do, but I struggle with this part of the Kiwer standard, even with prejudice presumed, as we would normally examine for Strickland purposes. We don't have that, but there's still the requirement that it have an actual adverse effect on the representation. So I'm kind of trying to find that, or trying to see if it's there, I guess it would be a better way to put it.
And I think that the case law supports exactly your question, and that's the quote from Strickland itself. Kiwer comes before Strickland,
right.
But Strickland mentions Kiwer in really carving out an exception in the prejudice prong coming from Kiwer. The Supreme Court states specifically, it is difficult to measure the precise effect on the defense of representation corrupted by conflicting interests. And I think that's really your question, Justice Kadish, goes to the heart of the problem. It's hard, once you have that conflict, it's very hard to measure, because the way I worded it in my brief is that it really infects the entire relationship.
Right.
And decisions that even grounds for the habeas claim that were dismissed at the evidentiary hearing are really, I think, interesting discussions as far as his decision to call the expert witness or not. All of those, and that's a strategic decision, but you're working with your counsel, hopefully, in making that decision. They could not have a traditional attorney-client relationship through the whole course of their case because, A, she turned him into police, and secondly, and even more egregiously in many ways, she's having a romantic sexual relationship with him.
That reminds me of something else I wanted to ask about. Judge Maddox did not resolve the dispute in testimony between the two of them about when the relationship began. He testified that it was before trial that it took on this sexual or romantic nature, and her testimony is that it was only after trial that happened. What do we do with that in terms of how that impacts what the result should be? In other words, if the relationship didn't start till after trial, why should he get a new trial?
I don't know that it's necessary to find a bright line or starting point in the relationship. It was very clearly an inappropriate relationship. She clearly knew she had a much closer or inappropriate relationship than any attorney should ever have in that context. The fact that she knew that he was relapsing was a result of her being so close to Mr. Fenton and his parents and his children that he was in custody of. And
about back when she made the welfare check call?
Yes. And she knew about that. And is that a romantic relationship? Not necessarily, but it shows that she had very early on in the case a interest in her client that went far beyond a professional attorney client. She was invested in his life very early on in the case. She knew she was watching his children. She was having dinner with his family, Christmas and Thanksgiving dinner. She admitted to all of that at the habeas hearing. And so, she doesn't craft this pen name of Portia Howard and start writing him romantic letters until he's in the Department of Corrections.
Right.
Sure. But Mr. Fenton testified very clearly, and Judge Maddox seemed to find it credible, that they start to have a romantic relationship as he's in the Elko County Jail. He makes an allegation that she's doing some pretty salacious activities to him while at the Elko County Jail. And I think notable, I have never heard.
Obviously, she testified to the contrary.
She did, and I that's notable to me for two ways. One, the only thing she won't totally candidly admit to is something that's arguably a felony criminal offense of sexual contact at a jail. And, I mean, of the many extraordinary things about this case, to have a habeas hearing wherein the prior counsel asks to have a recess, a continuance of a hearing so she can speak to her own counsel for fear of her of prejudice of criminal liability to herself is, I have never heard of that. And I think that's extraordinary. It shows truly how deep and pernicious and twisted her relationship with Mr. Fenton was. And it's very hard
Can I interject here, though? In terms of focusing on adverse effect under Coyler, you established that he felt inhibited or not able to be fully candid with his lawyer due to this relationship, and arguably that's an adverse effect of the conflict of interest. Are there other adverse effects that you would identify in this record to under that heading?
Specific examples, I mean, I would him decide not to testify, whether to call the expert witness he had here. The question there was, expert witness went to arguably not diminished capacity, but lack of specific intent for the crime. She ultimately decides not to call that expert witness because it would divulge mental health issues with Mr. Fenton. And a lot of these issues she knows about on a far more intimate level than and any other defense attorney would know of their client. She had intimate knowledge of his medical history, his hospitalizations, not purely from medical records, but in discussions with him and his family. She had been hanging out with his friends. And that decision, so I would argue, even that decision to not call the expert witness is colored by her very unusual personal relationship. Part of his defense is that he pointed to an alternate suspect, a Mr. Whitewater, that was a previous client of the Elko County Public Defender, not of Ms. Kilpatrick personally, but there is a
discussion. Do you have any? Excuse me, it's hard with the remote, and I apologize for that. Do you have any case law? The only cases that I found in this arena, and it surprised me, was the Utah case and the Military Justice Court case that your colleague cited, and I didn't find any others that went the other way, finding adverse effect due to a conflict that originated in a sexual relationship. Did you find any reported cases analyzing this?
Your Honor, I'm glad your research went along with mine. I did not find any case that I could point to. The State versus Cheek that my friend on the other side discussed earlier. Again, that was a sexual relationship in that case. What I think stands out in this case is that we're really talking about two conflicts. It's not, there is the sexual conflict, which in and of itself is prejudicial and incredibly problematic, as well as the separate, really entirely separate, breach of the duty of loyalty. And that's why I began my argument by saying, you could find that either one independently was prejudicial, and thus district court's finding below was correct, or certainly in combination. You could really, in crafting in your order here, limit this case to its facts, because the facts are quite extraordinary. And I don't know, certainly.
Our review would be deferential to the district court, in your opinion, the standard of review on appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's certainly the case law is very clear that you defer to, and that's the Lander case and State versus Powell, the Kirksey case. You certainly defer to the findings of facts from the court below, and the facts here, again, so extraordinary. And so Judge Maddox, I think, certainly made a rational decision and really the only decision supported by the law or the logic here.
Thank you. I have just sort of a state of the record. In reading the transcript of the hearing, I saw that your client was out of custody on parole. Is that still the case to your knowledge?
He is, and my understanding is his parole has actually expired based on the nature of the way his sentence was structured, although it was quite a long back end of the sentence, the 32 years, I believe. All his time credit went to the back end, and he is released from parole.
Okay.
That's my understanding. I tried my best to find
that. But he wants a new trial.
He certainly does, Your Honor.
What he's asking for.
He is, yes. And so obviously I think unlikely that he would ever, if he's found guilty again, go back into custody. But this is a young man who's restarted his life, is a decorated Army veteran who served this country very honorably in Iraq. And I think it just comes down to the felony convictions on his record. And so, yes, he would like a new trial.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. Let's counsel rebuttal, and we can add an extra minute because we went over. Go ahead.
So to Justice Pickering's question, the one thing that I was reminded is that we can point to another case where there was facts more egregious than this, arguably, and that is Barentine versus United States, 728 Federal Supplement 1241, and I believe that's out of the Western District of North Carolina in 1989. In that case, the defense counsel had an affair with the defendant's fiance, not the defendant himself, and defendant made no claim of error during his trial, so the court in that case did not grant relief. Excuse me. And so even when we're talking about the welfare check and the fact that Ms. Kilpatrick disclosed what happened and he was placed back into custody, the question that still remains is, what's the conflicting interest? What's her conflicting interest at that point to impose the Kyler standard? She still zealously represented him. All of the interest was still towards him to helping him.
But counsel, could her judgment have, I mean, yes, she was zealously on behalf of him, but someone who is in a personal relationship with somebody may be inclined to approach things differently than someone who is objectively arm's length counsel, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but at the same time, And that's the purpose of the rule, right? We're trying to avoid,
right.
I think more it's more victimization of the clients, but to protect that, and I think it's more in the civil context than anything, and specifically family law. But in this, her interests are aligned with his. If she does a good job and if he gets found not guilty, then he wins, she wins. And we don't look at any other relationships. People represent their friends all the time. And if a person represents their spouse that they got married well before the representation, we don't bat an eye at that. And assume that you have those two, again, assume you have those two different situations or those two where, depending on when the relationship started, you can make the same comments about the objectivity of the attorney. But why is it different just because of the timeline? And then how does that score up against the state's evidence at trial, which was, in this case, overwhelming?
I just want to ask you quickly about the Clark case here in Nevada, where we adopted Kyler, but as to adverse effect, we found that the actual conflict of interest there, getting a judgment against his client pending trial, that may well have had an adverse effect on his performance and therefore granted relief. Can you address that?
Yes, and I'd point to the quotes in State v. Cheek, which talk about you can't just sit here and speculate and hypothesize. about what that adverse effect was. There was nothing argued or pointed to in the record that there was an adverse effect. And in fact, to further that point, we could sit here and bounce hypotheticals off of each other all day long. And what the hypotheticals demonstrate for us is the need to look at this on a case-by-case basis, because not all these hypotheticals are created equal.
Sure. Okay, thank you. Did any of my colleagues have any more questions?
No.
Okay. All right, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Justice Kadish.
So the case will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess until the next call of the court.